Hello everybody, Quentin here, and welcome to the Transmission Podcast. Today we're speaking with Campbell Faulkner, Senior Vice President and Chief Data Analyst at OTC Global Holdings. Now, this conversation with Campbell, I absolutely loved, but we go into a lot of technical detail in places, which is quite off-brand for this podcast. And there were at times there were a lot of acronyms and technical detail about commodities and trading commodities. Now, I'm not a commodities expert, and if you're listening to this and you felt like it's difficult to keep up, then I also struggled to keep up with it too, because there was just so much that we talked about. That said, it was a wicked conversation. Campbell really knows his stuff. It's fascinating hearing what OTC General Holdings do in the market. And it comes in waves. So we've got an hour-long conversation, and we were deciding in the edit just now whether we were going to leave it all in or whether we would cut bits out because it got too technical. And we decided to leave it all in. So if you get to a bit in this podcast and you're not really sure what's going on, then just skip a bit. But for many of you, I think you're going to really, really enjoy this one. As ever, make sure you hit the subscribe button and we will see you soon. Here's Campbell. Campbell, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
We should probably start with the name of the company, OTC Global Holdings. So what does that mean?
Yeah, and it's always kind of an inside joke, and I know our general partners did that intentionally. It's for over-the-counter, since we are an over-the-counter interdealer broker. And kind of, you know, we started off as a number of interdealers. We kind of agglomerated, and that's really what it is. We're an over-the-counter interdealer broker, which, like I said, I know is a bit on the nose, but it's really who we are, particularly as a hidden industry, particularly as part of the financial services industry, we are rather hidden. So, yeah, again, there's us and a few others, and that's precisely why we did it that way. And I know that's kind of a cheeky answer instead of, you know, we have some, you know, long storied history. It's honestly to kind of give homage to the very industry that, you know, our general partners made their money in and, you know, what we continue to do.
And you talk about it being a hidden industry. So for our listeners, this is the first time that we've had someone on to talk about being an independent broker or an interdealer broker. And you're right. You guys perform a function that most of the world doesn't even know exists. So what does it mean to be a hidden industry, and what exactly do you do there?
So we are not the sexy side of the financial industry. We aren't the buy side. We are not, you know, a bank. We're not. The reason we mention that is we are very hidden. Typically, interdealers like to remain hidden. So some of the largest interdealers on the planet are BGC Group, TPI Cap, Traditional Financial Services, TFS, and there's some others. And these are very, very large, important intermediaries in the industry. And to be blunt, kind of outside of direct financials or, you know, strange people like me who like to invest in it, you know, to get access to my own industry, no one knows who the heck we are. And that's largely because we operate over the counter. So we're facilitating transactions that are entirely off venue. If they're traded, I put that in air quotes, largely because we're doing trades off venue, negotiate off venue. Some people's recollection of this has to do with dark pools and equities. Typically, and at least on our side, we're dealing with energy derivatives, but we don't exist within kind of the normal financial system, not one that you're going to normally hear about. You are not going to trade through us if you are trying to, you know, trade your personal equities. You're trying to, you know, maybe go do a little bit of WTI. You're going to do that through, you know, a prime broker, you know, basically a facilitator who's going to be, you know, designed for retail. We are purely wholesale. We facilitate transactions between Shell, BP. We facilitate transactions between very, very large hedge funds. And then also more relevant to this industry, if basically say a large wind provider is trying to hedge part of their PPA obligations, things like that, that's where we come in. So we are kind of a big iron. We're not trading single megawatt blocks on ice. We're helping you trade 10,000 megawatts. Or probably 10,000 watts, multiply that by megawatts. So it's a very different industry. And because of that, most people don't know us unless you're a direct trader. And I use myself as an example. I was recruited here 12 and a half years ago. I had no idea what we were. I thought we were more akin to a prime broker, which we are not at all. And that's kind of why we are hidden. It's mostly a your traders know who we are in trading firms. Maybe if you're going to be blocking some hedges through us, you're going to know who we are. Otherwise, you're not really going to have much interaction with us outside of, you know, maybe looking at an earnings call for BGC, for instance.
And you said lots of things that all sounded very exciting there about things being hedged and dark pools. I got memories of reading Michael Lewis's fantastic book, Flash Boys. But I know what you do isn't quite like that. You did a lot of describing what you don't do. But now let's talk about what you do do. So who's the customer and what service? You guys, you've got a very important role in the global commodities world. So who's the customer and what problem do you solve for them?
Yeah, and that's, and the reason we make pains, you know, both legally and just kind of in general descriptions to go about what we don't do is largely because we are hemmed in, you know, kind of by design into a non-custodial role. So our role is we're not taking positions in the market. We're not facilitating liquidity. And by that, I mean, we're not a market maker willing to just, you know, make and take. We are something entirely different and kind of, again, very special. We are there to help people who need to trade large positions, people who are there who need to, you know, hedge. The reason we mention hedge is we don't dislike speculation. There's people who need to do that, and they're providing liquidity, you know, back out into the market. But we are there to facilitate, you know, often you large transactions. You can't put a very large trade through an exchange. You will blow up the matching engine. They're not designed for that. They're designed to, you know, get small fills that are full. You come to us if you need to have a large position, you know, let's say you're, you know, naturally long or naturally short, you know, power plant, producer, your refinery, you have natural long and short positions that are rather large. So by extension, you're going to go to an interdealer to ensure that you can get a full fill, or if it's difficult to get a full fill, we'll take your, I'm just using 10,000 lots because it is a rather large trade size. We'll part that into multiple parts, help you get a more accurate average fill versus putting it into, you know, any straight through processing, you're going to blow up the matching engine. So because of that, our facilitation is really big, super major oil and gas companies, large utilities, hedge funds, people who take outsized positions in the market, not somebody looking to day trade. So we're very institutional.
So have I got this right? So I say, yeah, just to ask the question a bit like I'm a 5-year-old, because it's always good to do that. So have I got this right that there are big players that want to trade massive, massive positions of commodities in general? And you talked about oil there, gas, power, other commodities. But if they want to, say you want to buy, you talked in watts, which I thought was funny. Not funny, haha, but you're obviously talking about huge volumes, but you've simplified it to watts, which is, traders always blow my mind with the language. And so you want to buy a big position or sell down a big position. You can't do that all in one go because you can basically move the market. And so you guys are an intermediary, an interdealer between the BP or the Shell or the Exxon, for example, and the market, and that matching that bid and offer algorithm, or the matching algorithm as you call it, to maybe over a certain amount of time or a certain amount of blocks to spread that trade so you don't move the market or you don't signal anything, or there's probably loads of reasons why you do that. Is that correct?
Yes. And the polite way to say it is you come to us because you can't basically go through an exchange.
You're too big. Too big for an exchange.
Too big. And even back when the four existed, there was always off-venue transactions. You know, they were many years ago, two steps off the four, but those were not actually put into the pit. And that's kind of where the voice broker business started, and then it's kind of migrated that way.
When you say the pits, we're talking about
the actual trading pits.
Actual physical people, often dressed in really funny colors.
Correct.
Great. Running around, shaking pieces of paper at each other, and doing crazy hand signals back in the day. And if you're listening to this and you haven't seen photos of the CM Chicago's pit back in the day, it was just out of this. It looked like a rave. It looked like a 1980s. Manchester rave.
And so that was always the off venue. And that's, again, I put in air quotes because it sounds a little bit silly, but that's actually how it started. And so one of our general partners worked on the NYMEX for, I believe, for crude oil. Don't quote me on that, which I'm sure he'll yell at me at some point about. But, and so, you know, basically a lot of those guys, they would do off venue transactions because they were too big. Even with humans involved, if we're trying to trade, you know, 1,000 watts. I'm doing fake hand signals, but, you know, we're trying to trade 1,000 watts. You will materially move the market because each fill is going to push the price up or push the price down. So the purpose of us, you know, as interdealers is basically we're going to go to the market. We're going to function as an intermediary. Now, let's be realistic. Most trades, even when they're above minimum block size, which is statutory, we're not going to have multiple fills, but we do get trades that are sufficiently large where it may take a couple days to essentially get a trade, not because you're doing something illegal and holding trades. Also have to caveat that. What it is we know that, you know, a customer has, you know, 50,000 watts they need to offload. You know, they are want to fill here to keep their average price, you know, well within a range versus blowing it out. And so by doing so, you're providing anonymity to the customers, you're providing liquidity. You're also providing a fair and effective price for the market that without humans, frankly, if you threw it into an algorithm, it's going to blow up. I say that as a statistician. My business is algorithmically based, but the human factor is such a crucial part of why interdealers exist and their core function to the, you know, good functioning and healthy functioning of the market.
So let's get some scale around this, because you talked about watts and you guys trade all sorts of commodities. If we just start with hydrocarbons, for example, what kind of size position are you helping clients move or trade? So let's say oil, right? A typical customer comes to you, which is of course like a, there must be a, like a whale sized customer comes to you and says, "Hey, I've got to shift this oil, or I want to buy a load of oil over a certain time period," and it's your job to spread that out and nibble away at the market. As not to move the market. What kind of size are these deals?
So, yeah, and that, without going into too specific details around, you know, some of our statutorily regulated stuff and things like that, exceptionally large. So, you know, VLCC container cargo size, 600,000 barrels.
The BLCC.
VLCC, very large crude carrier. You know, 600,000 barrels, you know, 100,000 barrels is small. You know, if we're talking pipeline-borne quantities, these are very, very, very large quantities.
So this is a whole ship in size,
yes,
or even multiple
full of crude oil.
Full of crude oil.
Yeah. Or in our case, LNG carriers full of, you know, I can't remember how many metric tons. Those are the sorts of sizes of deals. And the thing is, we're not doing one of those a week. We're doing multiple of those per day.
Wow.
And so remember, there's obviously your physical cargo side, which we do, you know, physical trading as well. And then there's the seniorage aspect where basically your, you know, financial market is many multiples of your physical, basically because lots of people have interest in that market. Derivatives markets by their very nature are zero sum. So obviously you're going to have, you know, multiple size of that market. So because of that, people are using those derivative instruments, derivative off of the physical, to basically provide a risk management mechanism, long or short, doesn't matter if you're speculating or using that to lay off risk. So because of that, you know, we're dealing with, you know, North Sea Brent cargoes all the time, huge barge cargoes of naphtha, NGLs, you know, I shouldn't say NGLs, that's very North American, but, you know, like bottle gas, things like that. And then we deal with pipeline-based cargoes. When I say cargoes that are pipeline-based, I mean like petroleum products, natural gas. So because of that, you know, terawatt hours per year of power, we're dealing with, I don't even want to think about the notional size in billions. Our fraction as interdealer is teeny tiny. And that's because, again, we're providing, you know, transaction facilitation. You know, we're not over here taking huge positions in trading. We're not a VTOL, Mercuria. We're not a BP Shell. We don't own assets. I make pains to say that because some people think we're, you know, an interdealer or probably a prime dealer where we take positions. We are merely, you know, facilitating the functioning of the market, and that's it.
And so thinking back to the, because it's kind of easier, thinking back to the olden days where it was humans running around with pieces of paper in the pit, a big whale would come along, big oil company or power company, and say, "Hey, I need to hedge this position," whether that's, or it could be physical cargo. I want to hedge it with non-physical derivatives. And they come to the edge of the pit and they look inside the pit and everybody's looking at them saying, "What are you going to do?" And so they come to you guys instead, and you split that up across lots of different pieces of paper and go and spread it around quietly to get the best price and not move the market. And as you say, not blow the market up. What are the key parts about the name of your company is OTC, which is over the counter. And that's a really important part of the role that interdealers play. And I guess this whole position that you guys take in the market, position's a strong word, but the role that you have in the market is only really possible in OTC, right? So what is OTC? What does that mean to folks who don't know, they're new to the world of trading, as I am?
Well, let's break down actually over the counter. And so it was either Chicago Mercantile Exchange or CBOT, I forget which. They actually had counters, you know, basically counters around their actual pits. And so,
what do you mean by
not
a counter?
Like the pit,
a person, base, literally,
almost like a bar counter. And so oh, you right, physically okay. go up to. I know it sounds bizarre, but actually, if you look at some of the old photos of the pits, you would see these basically counters, and it was so you could go do merchant transactions or, you know, basically go make sure clearing's good and things like that, settle up. So typically what would happen is it'd be off venue, lunch hours, things like that. Or if you had a particularly large position that somebody called in, you would go do an over-the-counter transaction, which means you would basically go get guys on either side of the counter and transact. Which is a little bit, like I said, it's on the nose, you know, but it actually makes perfect sense because that is our legacy. And so that's where kind of the OTC term came from, over the counter. We're going to go basically do this off venue. So we're not in the pit. So we're off the venue. So there's different governing rules for if you're in the venue or off the venue.
And so for the folks listening, I'm sure many have already seen these photos, but you're talking about like a stage in the round, a bit like the Colosseum, if you like, not to go back too far in history. And you've got this pit in the middle where people are running around exchanging stuff. And then outside, there's a whole load of support actors and computer screens and administration and back office and stuff that's happening, who are not governed by the same rules as the folks running around inside the pit making the deals. And hence all the hand signals and the great costumes and all that. Costumes is a strong word, maybe uniforms. And so when you talk about the rules being different outside the pit, the over-the-counter bit is about connecting the bits in the governed area and the non-governed area, isn't it?
Yes, and it's doing so in a way that the reason we emphasize not moving the market, and that's really why we continue to exist all these years later. You know, we have very sophisticated algorithms and things like that. They don't deal with large block sizes, and blocks are important because, you know, that's the governing term for, you know, basically the lot sizes of what you're actually transacting. But that's really where it came from, where I need to move some large amount of, you know, typically ag commodities where it started, potato futures, which you can't trade anymore because of, you know, some lovely activities in the United States. But those sorts of agricultural derivatives, I need to sell, you know, I have 50 barnfuls of potatoes. I can't do that on the floor. You know, we're typically doing small transaction sizes. We're trying to facilitate those. We're going to go do those over the counter. So I'm going to go get a representative. I'm going to talk and be like, okay, I need to go back to the floor and maybe sell this in 5, 10, 15 different shots to move that entire transaction. Here's each fill. Instead of moving the transaction price this wide, we move it that small because we're actually trying to part it and we're not showing our hands. So essentially, again, we're an intermediary. The broker functions to basically act as an agent on behalf of both sides. So you're basically making sure everybody's getting an effective fill. You know, yes, spreads are wide in OTC derivative markets, but that's largely because of liquidity spreads, not because the broker is doing something untoward, yeah. You know, spreads are fixed. So it's more, we're going to make sure that those sides get matched. Everybody goes home happy. You know, you get your risk profile you're looking for.
And how do you guys, moving on from the mechanics of the trading pit, which is just fascinating that it's been a long time.
Still
since,
informs everything today.
Yeah. All the parlance of that whole world, even in now everything's digital, still stands. And the operating models of the different partners and people in the process. But how does, so your company, OTC Global, or OTC Global Holdings, how do you balance the traditional products, so the commodities like crude oil, with emerging areas to you like power and renewables in your operations?
The blunt way to say it is, if it's a derivative, we like it, particularly an energy derivative. For us, it's all pretty much the same. Again, this is a very, it seems like we're just, you know, trying to make crosses in the market, but we are. You know, we look at emerging desk all the time. you know, ethanol is a huge business for us. I just mentioned that as, you know, we have like a lot of biofuels. We do carbon's growing. It's, you know, obviously EUA and UKA and Europe are big carbon markets, but, you know, in the United States, it's not quite as big. We do, you know, some nature-based stuff. The reason I'm saying that is we're always looking for the next derivatives market. And it's something that from an energy side, our customers, be it, you know, an Exxon on down to, you know, a very small renewables developer, we want to service them. And from our perspective, it's difficult to deal with these products. You're trying to trade into a market that is often opaque by design. There's often very few counterparties. And so it's our job to help you on either side, if you're a buy or sell, get an effective cross. So we don't look at it and say, we're just going to stick with crude oil. We're just going to stick with natural gas. We're very agnostic towards energy derivatives. The reason I keep saying energy derivatives is our business is focused on energy. We kind of don't do anything outside of that. We have a tiny bit of metals. That's not to disparage our metals desk. They're very successful, but it's just our core focus is energy. So as such, if it's an energy derivative product, we're always looking to be in it, particularly if we can find an edge.
And I should have asked this at the start, but the baseball card for the company, how many people are in the company and what are the stats?
Yeah, without going into anything proprietary, since we are private, and that's kind of an important function, you know, kind of as we operate, we have probably between contractors and full-time, we're probably around 600 people, and that's spread across globally. So that's Houston, Chicago, Louisville, New York, Geneva, London, Singapore, good Lord. And we're, you know, we're fortunate that we're growing. You know, the interdealer market is pretty ruthless, and a lot of interdealers are slowly contracting. It's not a bad thing. It's, you know, the markets are difficult and, kind of like a lot of different markets, it's Pareto principle, you know, 20% of the brokers get 8% of the revenue, and vice versa. So we've been fortunate that we've been able to grow where we have, and maintain our market position and grow market position elsewhere. So yeah, long story short, yeah, kind of our baseball card, we're a little private about, and that's just kind of by nature of the fact we are a limited partnership.
But imagine big, long numbers. That's all we need to do. Imagine lots of big, long numbers.
Yes. High trade numbers each day. One thing I will say, the interdealer market, you know, it's a great market to be in. It's a good market to own. It is ruthlessly competitive. So as such, you know, commissions for the brokers, you know, there's no collusion. It's shrinking. And so that's one of the difficult parts. And so that's why, you know, if I am going to use our pitch book, we're very technology focused. You know, brokers do a lot of their own work here. We don't have, you know, 50 corks per broker. It's trying to make sure we streamline that. By extension, that means that we can provide better service to the customers. We can offer lower commissions. We don't want to lower our commissions, but, you know, if we need to maintain market share and things like that, gives us a tremendous amount of competitive advantages, allows us to continue to employ brokers and have the brokers be successful. So it's the complicated way to say it is we're a very old school business with a very new school feel in terms of, you know, technology enablement. And we're pretty lucky that we have, you know, by investment, by also some of the technologists we have inside, we've reduced a lot of our cost, which is good for the broker, good for the company. Sorry, I am talking our book a little bit, but it means that, you know, reduce errors, reduce, you know, regulatory fines, which is a growing problem for the industry, and also provide, again, you know, quality execution for the customer.
One of the unique things about being in your position is that you get to see both sides of the market in a very, you get to see the, in, thinking back to the pit in Chicago, you get to see inside the pit and outside the pit behind you. You get to see both sides, and you're working on the buyer side and the sell side in both physical and non-physical. And for this reason, you must get really, really good data on trends in the market, because you see the opaque things as well as what's public. So as you're looking at global markets and commodities, what a bit of a cheeky question, but what trends are you seeing from your position or the firm's position, particularly through a energy lens?
Oh, man. One of the best ways to say it is we're both behind and ahead. And I say that not because, you know, trying to, you know, hedge or provide a politically correct answer. So we definitely see where people are willing to put their money on. And that does matter because a cross in the market is a very material amount of information. Someone took the position, put the trade on, is willing to commit capital for it, regardless of however long it went on, you know, and then insufficient number, which the best part of being an interdealer, as you said, is we see both sides. You kind of do get general trends. You know, we have, you know, particular markets in North America, we've seen kind of a shrinking. And that's largely due to regulatory structure. And there's kind of a big desire, and I'm not talking OTC's book here or mine necessarily. There is a big desire for people to be able to trade out, you know, forward power price agreements and stuff like that. And it's too expensive to do so. We've seen in other parts of the world that
What, just to stop you there before you carry on, what does that mean? It's getting expensive. Expensive for whom and why?
So we had a big shift starting in 2012. We had swaps to futures, which was part of Dodd-Frank, 2008, basically financial regulatory bill, which touched the derivatives market, probably shouldn't have, but it was tied up with kind of the MBS stuff. And then that backfed into the energy derivatives market as well. And so what that did is swaps were typically traded and were a very big name in North America because they were less expensive. Required less capital meant that, you know, ICE may have had an unfair advantage, but they did have an advantage over, you know, the other derivatives exchanges, basically saying, hey, small amount of capital, you can go trade these positions. That and was good.
A swap, as in we're talking about not the physical here. We're talking about, no physical. Is it
exchange of cash flows.
Yes. Yeah,
So even though it looked like a future, and that's the, you know, from a derivatives modeling standpoint, I'm going to really out myself. Everything can be modeled as a swap. Even options, you just have swaps with timings, your multiple legs, things like that. It's going to net out. But since everything could be modeled as a swap, we can create a futurized product that's not a future, that functions as a future, that's a swap. So prior to that, I know.
If you're listening to this, well done. Not legal advice. Firstly, not legal advice. Secondly, if you're running to a whiteboard to draw this out, there's lots of arrows moving around. Well done for sticking at it. It's going to get simpler in a minute, but we'll carry on. So, carry on.
No, so Dodd-Frank effectively closed that. So in fall of 2012, basically swaps were futurized. You could have had SEFs, swap execution facilities, which do exist in other markets, you know, fixed income, FX. But in the energy space, it's effectively dead. Everything got futurized. Everybody kind of said, okay, yeah, we understand these instruments. But what that did is, because of span margins and everything else, we'll set aside nodal exchange and EEX because they have a slightly different model. But, you know, span margin and everything else on futurized products is expensive. You know, your maintenance margin could be a lot. So that provides a huge hurdle for a lot of people in the market. So why am I saying this? Well, we've had notional open interest expand since that time. The total between, and obviously these numbers are not concrete.
Just to clarify for our audience. So open interest means people with buy or sell orders, right?
Correct. It just means standing open, so not closed, unfilled positions in the market that are still active.
Yeah.
And the reason that's such an important, you know, volumetric measure is it basically shows a willingness to enter into a zero-sum market because derivatives markets are zero-sum. Equities are not, fixed income are not, most other markets are not, but within derivative space, those are in fact zero sum. And I have to caveat that because people will try to, you know, take me to the woodshed over it.
But there's lots of, the point is there's lots of money on the sidelines that wants to transact, but just isn't because the price or the products aren't going where they need them to.
Sure. And so the one point I'll make is while we've had notional OI go up, which is notional, just the outstanding, we have actually had, you know, overall trading volume come down. And that's what I can say as an interdealer, you know, sitting in an interdealer broker. And that's largely because it's just so darn expensive. And so because of that, it makes it more expensive if you're trying to hedge certain things in the market. The old joke used to be if you had $50,000 and a computer, you were a hedge fund. That's because, you know, basically I know it's a horrible joke, but the barrier to entry used to be sufficiently low that you could go start trading on ICE and call it good. Once all that got futurized, that means that it's much more difficult if you are a small-time developer to hedge out, you know, PPA, hedge out, you know, something you're doing for building out a facility, things like that. So that's actually screwed up some of the capital formation tools that actually allow you to ensure cash flow.
So what's happened is we had the boom years in the 2008 financial crisis, and then Both sides of the pond, we had different regulations. We had Dodd-Frank in the US, and I can't remember the one in Europe and UK about essentially.
Oh, there's the Basel series.
Basel, they're all credit tied cover up, yeah. And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
but what you're saying is, I think I understand, is then the regulator stepped in and said, we got to sort out the system because we had the financial crisis. But what that's ended up doing is making it much more expensive to transact, and that's reduced liquidity and reduced trading volumes. So we had the financial crisis almost over 15 years ago.
Plus years ago.
But
yeah.
Since then, the reaction has actually reduced liquidity and reduced the amount of money flowing in the sector.
Well, and it's done that, and that kind of got papered over with, you know, basically low interest rates. And that's really one of the things we've seen is interest rates have, you know, pulled back the curtain a little bit. There's really kind of that big yawning gap of, oh, shoot, you know, we can't lend anymore because we don't have basically a zero, you know, interest rate or effectively zero interest rate that, you know, we're borrowing at, you know, as a lending institution. And that's really where we've seen from our side, and obviously without, you know, outing anyone, our private equity partners are much, much more concerned about, you know, who they're actually going to do project financing for. 5 years ago was kind of whatever we're going to throw it at it, we can, you know, find a way to make it work. So because of that, we've kind of hit that inflection point where, you know, you're trying to make sure that you can maintain cash flow using derivatives as a tool to do so. A lot of folks are like, well, shoot, it's too darn expensive. We don't have zero interest rates. It's really kind of crimping a lot of development. It's one of those strange things where I sound like I'm talking, you know, our pure interviewer book because I want volume. I'm actually not. I'm saying this more as kind of working with our product development and finance folks and other parts of our business. And they're really struggling because they're like, look, I want to do this deal, but it's too darn expensive for us to go basically hedge this out and use, you know, a very vibrant derivatives market. But the problem is there's not enough folks like us transacting in it. So when we go actually trying to, you know, post our, you know, collateral and everything else, go get an FCM, the FCM's like, the heck are you guys doing over here? You're not really trading. It's like, well, no, we're not. We're trying to make sure we hedge this. Then they go to a credit sleeve and get, you know, scalped essentially because the credit sleeve's wearing that and then trying to make their margin on. There's nothing wrong with the credit sleeves. They're providing the service, but all that's done is basically have kind of a knock-on effect of, you know, the industry. And so you're asking, well, we see these plants getting developed and now we're no longer seeing these plants getting developed. It's kind of that double-edged sword, interest rates plus basically cost of capital if you're going to trade.
And coming back to the question about trends and what you guys see, if you had to look at the North American market and European market and say, this is a broad market, but say the Asian market, how are they comparing against each other? Are there markets that are growing in liquidity and growing in significance globally? Is there a move of liquidity from, and I'm putting words in your mouth here, but is there a move in liquidity from Europe to the US because of the shale oil revolution? Or is there, because of so much demand growth in Asia, is that now having a big, big impact? What are you guys seeing on the macro side?
Yeah, and that's actually a very, very good question. So we've seen kind of not a wholesale movement, but we've seen a lot of interest go to Europe, particularly from the US. And I'd say that's not because the derivatives market is less mature in Europe. I'd just say it's been kind of a great example is the power market in Europe is now a very vibrant trading market where it used to just function for utilities to kind of trade day ahead and real time power 5 years ago. And that's, you know, basically borne out by the Danish experiment, which has been massively successful and massively profitable. That's huge. So there's been a big inrush of capital there. And typically how this works, there's inrushes of capital and things like that. You know, gas basis was, you know, my God, that was kind of the late 90s tied up with Henry Hub. So we've seen a big movement of capital there. We've seen a movement of capital more so than I would have thought, but massive movements to European refined products, bottle gas, things like that. It's just largely because of kind of the importance of the continent. Additional, you know, fuel for that fire. I know a bit of a bad statement, but it was because of the Russia-Ukraine war. And then we had basically the large, you know, boost in energy prices that just kind of put a focus on, you know, European energy. And then Asia, there's been an interest there for years. I mean, great example is Japanese power just recently started trading as futurized products a couple of years ago. It's still kind of trying to get along, but we've kind of seen, you know, the old Enron model, we can, you know, create a market around anything. so to speak. And that's kind of been, I know it's a horrible example, but it is true. It's, we've seen kind of this continuation.
Well, it worked until it didn't.
Works until it didn't. But in a lot of these cases, there are places where these markets are not sufficiently developed. You know, the U.S. domestic, you know, power markets, you know, particularly talking about futures, is insane. It's very complex, large amounts of competitive venues. We're starting to see that Europe really went from, I'm not going to say a backwater of like gas and power trading. It's always been very important, but it was much more constrained to the utilities. Now we've seen a large amount of interest. So it's not that it's growing away from North America. It's just that it's in a different phase of its development. And so there's always interest in like South America and places like that. A lot of it's got to deal with working with government agencies, to be totally blunt. And, you know, is it permissive or not? EU is rather permissive. UK is permissive. Certain parts of Asia are permissive. Those aspects will help grow those markets. Crude oil's always been international, particularly cargo borne. So those are growing. The large and polite way to say it is, you know, there's a lot of growing derivatives markets. Once they become boring, it's good for consumers. It's bad for us. Because obviously we like volatility, and there's always naturally volatile products like natural gas, for instance, and domestically here. But I'm not trying to give a non-answer. It's one of those where, you know, without showing our cards, yeah, there's a lot of investment. There's a lot of continued movement. You know, where you're not going to see, in my opinion, huge growth is like Abu Dhabi and you know, like the Murban contracts and stuff like that. And that's largely because you're a single seller.
Yeah.
And those markets will kind of always be relatively constrained because of that. It's really when you can kind of get dynamic markets like you're going to have, you know, Southern Europe, places like that, Eastern Europe, which difficult markets, but they're kind of, you know, interesting as well. Places like Singapore, Japan, you know, those are the places that we kind of see growth. But again, it's the derivatives market. There's always a need for additional new products.
And you talked about volatility being good for you in your role. Volatility is now a defining characteristic of energy markets, but especially power markets, for lots of different reasons, but predominantly the move from baseload fossil power to more flexible or intermittent renewables, alongside lots of other reasons. And so you mentioned earlier about your firm having your secret sauce, putting words in your mouth, is about data and AI and access to information. And so if we tie those two things together, where volatility is now a defining characteristic of power markets, and you guys spend a lot of time in the data, what's your firm doing from a data perspective to get a handle on the volatility in power markets?
And I make that kind of big aside as, you know, someone who's personally been modeling power markets for approaching 15 years. And as a, you know, aside to that, it's absolutely flipping brutal. You know, just, geez, what was it last week? Right before the end of the year, we had some weather reports that, you know, said a large part of the United States is going to freeze. Then we had power and natural gas prices, you know, spike to the moon for the, you know, December BALMO and then, you know, Jan-Feb strips. So as a part of that, you know, the polite way to say it is the broker's job is to be in touch with the market. So they're listening to their traders, they're taking the orders. They're also getting information to help their traders. You know, good brokers are, they know their positions. They know that, you know, this may be an advantageous time to go to their trader and say, hey, you know, do you need to hedge this? Do you want to offload this? You know, how can we help you optimize your portfolio? Not because we're telling them how to trade, very important part, but we're not telling them how to trade. It's one of those where you're helping facilitate the transaction. So as a part of that, our guys are probably more in the weeds than even I am about a lot of markets, trying to make sure that they understand, you know, the weather, what's changing. You know, they're looking at 0Z, 12Z, trying to figure out how can I help their customers. And as part of that, you know, from my data analytics side, you know, we're very different from the other interdealers. You know, we're not just taking broker data and then saying, this is what the market is. Far from it. You know, the brokers know their aspect of the market. You know, a broker typically maintains, you know, four or five different individual, we're going to say curves. Those are kind of their markets. But, you know, a great example is in North American Power, there's like 900 different curves that are actively traded. So even if we have the largest power desk in the industry, it's a teeny tiny proportion. How do you mark all of that? And as a function of that, we provide the analytics back to the brokers so that they can say, we have an off quoted, you know, PJM, you know, market location. We need to know where it is, but we don't just want to, you know, try to go poll 50 different people, because one, you're going to show your, you know, market position to other people in the market. And so that kind of negates the purpose of the interdealer. So by being able to, you know, warehouse a lot of that analytics in-house, they can then go to their customers and intelligently say, hey, this is where, you know, our internal analytics is seeing it. You know, we have a bid ask about this wide, you know, we should be able to transact within that. Not always, because you may have somebody saying, no, I will not sell unless we move it up here, move it down here, and it's going to actually be that much wider. But that gives them the ability to actually mark and cover those. And that's really where we do it. It's not so much AI. So we do use AI models, you know, ordinary least square, you know, generalized ordinary least squares, things like that, you know, some autoregressive models, stuff like that are classified as AI. We're not using, you know, XGBoost and a lot of, you know, other things like that. And the reason I make those pains is, you know, we, you know, as a practitioner of statistics, it's much more rooted in, we need to provide something that's predictable. Broker understands it. We understand it. We understand how it's priced. And that's really the value we provide back to the market. We're not trying to beat the market. Neither the broker nor the data analytics side. What we're trying to do is we're trying to provide something that is a fair value. And the fair value assessment is the most important thing. You need something that's reasonable. You can go negotiate, because again, these are off venue. And so, you know, that's the broker's job is, you know, you're, you know, 35 bid 40, this guy wants to pay 32. How do we, you know, get closer to 35, or we may have to move it down to 34. And that's, you know, the natural function of the market. And it's a good thing, because it allows for off venue negotiation with intelligence, versus, you know, we're going to say 30 bid at 45 and then no one's going to transact. And that's not good if you're trying to lay off risk.
And so, Campbell, I need to ask you about, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you about energy storage. So so what role do you see energy storage playing in power markets? It's obviously a small part, a tiny part of the market compared to some of the mind-blowing numbers that you're talking about. But in an industry that's growing really, really quickly, and looking at how storage is used in other markets, such as, you know, traditional commodities or anything really, power is the last bastion where finally we have a storage solution. And so what do you think that's going to do to these markets?
It's weird. So we're fortunate to work with directly on my side, a number of energy storage units, or pardon me, energy storage companies, traditionally around battery storage. No one's going to like me saying this. It's essentially just pump storage with a different type of medium. You're pumping
How
electrons instead
you,
of water.
Campbell. How yeah, dare you? Right. We've had enough. We're going to switch off now.
Yeah. But functionally, it is the same. And that's part of the optimization problem. That's part of the development problem. And I know that's part of the trading problem that a lot of these firms face is, you know, it's like you have a call option, you know, you're naturally long, but you have a discharge. You have, you know, basically structuring that. How do you actually time it? It's a very, very complex problem, particularly given the current technology and design parameters, you know, typically 3 hour duration or less, oftentimes 60 minutes or less. Effectively pricing that's hard, effectively dispatching that's incredibly difficult. So because of that, I look at it from the standpoint of, I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity there. Right now, I'm going to just pick on ERCOT since I happen to live there. Right now, it's basically a rent seeking activity where you can kind of bid into ancillary services. When I say rent seeking, that's the economic term. I'm not, you know, criticizing the battery developers. They should be bidding in there. It's exactly what you should be doing. Maximize for your shareholders, maximize your ability to bid. So because of that, how do we deal with that in the future? How do we deal with that from a derivative space? It's complicated. We've seen ICE list products, nodal list products to help deal with that. Your charge discharge cycles, you know, your solar incident curves, which, you know, coincide kind of with battery charge, you know, charge curve levels, stuff like that. But as a consequence of that, we've started seeing fun things like in, you know, CAISO, where now off peak is often greater than peak in certain months, not just like in day ahead in real time months. Those sorts of changes really sway kind of the pricing dynamic and things like that. They also make investment decisions exceptionally difficult, because the reality right now is, we'll just again use ERCOT before real time co-optimization, you kind of have a nice rent. And if I'm going to build my new storage, particularly long duration storage, based off of a rentier assumption off of ancillary services, that may not be the case in January of next year. And because of that, does that mean that we're going to then have generation problems or generation shortfalls as we continue to have load growth? And this is where, you know, people get paid way more than I do. You have to kind of have the vision, the insight, and frankly, the balls to say, no, we have a view as to how we compete in an energy market, how we can actually model these, and how we can actually operate these assets correctly.
I guess ERCOT's a special case, isn't it? Because the pace
ERCOT's a special case, but ERCOT's just a leading case.
It's a leading case. But if you buy into the... which a lot of the world doesn't, it feels like a lot of the world hasn't woken up to this yet, but I 100% believe into this narrative, the electrification narrative and what that means for global load growth. ERCOT is the canary in the coal mine for this.
Correct.
But yeah, at the moment, it feels like an edge case because load growth is so aggressive. I mean, even when, even when power systems were first designed, and they were never designed in, you know, they didn't really grow from scratch to a design like they are right now.
No.
But the kind of growth, adding 10 gigs in a year or two, is just bonkers. And so no one's really known how to handle this stuff. And then yet, in the year 2024, you actually, or 2025, where we are now, you have more red tape than ever. So you have this competing issue of more bureaucracy and more treacle to walk through, and then the fastest load growth in absolute terms than really the world's ever seen. And tricky old scenario. Hey, let's switch to some predictions. So if you from what you guys see in the market, if you had to predict, what do you think is the and you can have a couple here, but what would you say is the biggest transformational shift in the global commodity markets? What's the big picture thing that you guys in your strategy meetings are really talking about? What's the big trend?
And this is the hard part, because to be blunt, we've been wrong so many times. I could personally state that with, you know, prognostication, predicting stuff. Really, the big one that kind of caught us flat-footed and caught ERCOT flat-footed is low growth. The assumption was we had 30 years prior to probably the last 7-10 years of essentially stagnant load growth globally, outside of developing markets. I'm talking about, you know, continental Europe, places like that, even Japan. Set aside any population concerns, it was kind of, you know, the energy efficiency, you know, hallmark. Like, we built up a bunch in the 40s, 50s, 60s, rural electrification in the United States, also across other parts of Europe after, you know, post-World War II. And then we just kind of stopped. And that was interesting. And then we started kind of having low growth around IT starting in the late 90s, but nobody talked about it. Like, you built the data center, it was fine, it was a load, okay. And we had, you know, extant plants. And then all of a sudden it kind of hit, you know, everything started hitting the anvil very tightly and getting smashed. And then people were saying, oh my God, what the hell is this? And that's really been the big thing. So, not just because I like electricity and that's a big part of my portfolio. The explosive growth of electrical consumption is unbelievable. You can attribute that to a number of things, EVs, heat pumps, God only knows what else. And the current one is, you know, AI and IT.
15 but the point gigs is, of Bitcoin miners. it's like coming as an Englishman living in Texas, that is, give or take a couple of gigs here or there, but it's like the total baseload nuclear power of the UK consumed. So all of the nukes in the UK,
all of them, all the time, going
straight to Bitcoin mining in one state.
And then they'll turn off. And then they'll instantly turn off. If they get a SCED disp, that's the even more bananas part.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I actually think it's a good
thing. No. It's just crazy.
It's just like, as an intellectual experiment, it is just crazy.
No, it's like, how do you go from having, you know, basically 10 gigawatts and you can turn it off within 30 minutes? It's like, that's not a normal industrial load. No, so electrification's been huge, and that's had a massive amount of knock-on effects in the industry. A great example of that is, you know, gas. Holy cow, the spark matters more than ever, particularly in North America. It matters in the UK. It matters a ton of places because at the end of the day, still driving the marginal, you know, price is spark.
Spark being the difference between the...
Yes, apologies.
Sorry.
Yeah, basically, how much does it cost to take, you know, an MMBTU of gas and then turn that into kilowatts? Apologies. So the spark spread. Yeah. So the spark spread really does matter. You know, dark spread, which I would have said a couple of years ago was still going to matter. You know, coal's really been effectively pruned because it's bad dark spread versus spark. So that's been a big shift. Kind of one of the other ones for us is basically the decline of Brent. And everyone's saying, oh my God, Brent's a huge benchmark. They had to include domestic grades from the United States in Brent. That's interesting. You know, we've kind of had the North Sea decline. That is going to change markets pretty dramatically, particularly if ICE and Platts, by extension, are not able to be defensive of that benchmark. What then becomes the global waterborne benchmark? Sure as hell isn't going to be WTI, given, you know, Platts fighting around it.
This is a whole podcast in itself. But I mean, for listeners, so the oil you buy in different, not to condescend, if I'm condescending you as a listener, I'm very sorry, but trying to keep everyone up here. The quality and specification of the oil that you buy in different places around the world to different benchmarks is different. And that blows my mind in itself. You'd think that a barrel of oil is a barrel of oil is a barrel of oil, and it's not. And as production moves from legacy production facilities in Europe and other places to predominantly fracking in the US, you end up seeing a lot more volume in a different place measured in a different way.
Yeah, and that's one of those, speaking about our crude oil, you know, book specifically, that's drastically changed, you know, our customer base, what people want. You know, a great example is most sophisticated, you know, refineries run on heavy crude because it was cheap and available. Well, now predominantly you have light crude. This is why we export crude from the United States now, which is just unfathomable even, you know, 10 years ago. That's the sort of stuff that does trade, you know, change trading. It does change, you know, consumption behavior. That sort of stuff has really kind of had a knock-on effect in our industry as well. Unrelated but related, you know, we still have diesel-powered, you know, basically generators like in the Northeast, simply because of political decisions to not build pipelines to places like Massachusetts. We are burning diesel. You know, these are the types of things with having diesel and oil units that you're like, well, why do I care about oil prices when I'm talking about electricity? That's your marginal spark there, you know, is a bad analogy. So these are the sorts of kind of confounding things that I've gotten wrong, the firm's gotten wrong. We're fortunate that we are not a long, short hedge fund. So all we have to do is make sure that we have, you know, good quality human capital there to, you know, help facilitate transactions, which I'm not reducing the brokers. They're very important, but it's a human capital management exercise.
Well, I guess the only thing you can predict, is that with the transition to net zero and all of the stresses and regulatory issues around that, that you can expect a lot more government intervention in markets in the next decade or so, which is probably the hardest thing to predict at all, because governments themselves find it very tricky to figure out the impact. You know, it's the whack-a-mole thing, right? You do something over here, and you talked about there about not building a pipeline and ending up with essentially the spread being defined by diesel in the Northeast. So you have all these little things. And I guess you can predict one thing for the next decade for global commodities, which, you know, I know very little about at all compared to someone like you, but is that the government is going to be putting their hand in the market a lot more than they have been historically. So we shall see.
It's one of those where, you know, stuff has been successful largely particularly where it's been emergent. And that's, you know, purely kind of on its own, you know, in a very Smithian view of, you know, emergent phenomenon. Anywhere where
we're getting niche now.
Yeah, I was about to say anywhere where it's not, you know, and this is me, you know, kind of speaking as a statistician. Like I, you can see very strange trends in data, and it's almost always what the hell happened regulatory wise. It may not be. It could just be something like, you know, pipeline blew up, but it's always something very shock, and you're like, okay, we can point to that. Those are existential and those are tough. You know, particularly if you're trying to make investment decisions, you're trying to, you know, do build. The polite way to say it is, again, people get paid a hell of a lot more than I do because they're willing to, you know, make calculated bets around that. And that's a huge issue for us. You know, bringing it back to the energy side, we survive because of, you know, minimum block sizes. So, you know, if you trade over a minimum block size, it depends per instrument, you know, it's going to come to us because that is essentially negotiated between NFA, us, you know, the regulatory agency, CFTC, exchanges, et cetera. Let's say that an administration, it doesn't matter what the political bent is, but they change and they decide we don't want over-the-counter trading anymore. Not good for our entire industry, and I'd argue not good for the industry or just general people overall, because it's going to increase transaction cost. But, you know, again, I am talking my own book, but there's a lot.
Is that something you guys talk about? Is that a government could come in and say no more? I'm just trying to think about European power, for example, is the kind of the market that I know
best. We talk the amount of happy hour times and the amount of very serious, sober conversations at 9 o'clock in the morning about regulatory shifts that could basically put us out of business happen every day. Yes. And it's one of those where it's both personal because, you know, obviously our livelihoods and business are tied up in it. We've also seen, you know, the best way to say it is the NFA, National Futures Association, without getting into trouble with my general counsel. They are a regulatory body that is a self-regulatory entity. And you're like, what the hell is a self-regulatory entity? Well, those basically go to the actual statutory regulatory entities, both UK, US, and otherwise, and say, let us regulate ourselves. Seems strange. And then those regulatory powers are delegated. So as a function of that, we kind of have like a strange interface where we're like, well, why are we getting pushed here? How do we not have that? And what it all boils down to is we're constantly afraid that, you know, essentially our markets are going to be told everything has to be cleared. Because again, the exchanges are also a regulator, which is an even more complex position. So we're kind of constantly in a limbo where we're trying to provide the best transaction, the cheapest transaction for our customers over the counter that doesn't move the market, doesn't reveal their positions, provides all these, you know, residual and tangible benefits that there's a large part of people, Elizabeth Warren, for instance, who are like, why the hell is this occurring? This should all be, you know, purely where we can see it because everybody needs to know everybody else's transaction. And, you know, we come back to the whole argument of these are transactions between, you know, adults, as in you can't just go trade commodities. You have to have a big boy account because these are institutional by design. These cannot be public. And it's not because someone's trying to hide something. It's going to come out if somebody's manipulating a market. We're not talking fraud. We're just talking about ensuring people can transact and allay risk. And largely what does laying off risk mean? It means that you basically have a way to hedge your cash flow so your company doesn't go bankrupt if you have a shift in commodity prices, which your company can't control. So again, like I said, we do worry very much about
somebody killing. I didn't realize it becomes so political. And the idea that
it has nothing to do with any particular political party. So I will make that clear. I'm not staking out a political position. It's one of those where, no, it's more people don't understand what over-the-counter trading is. People think it's some nefarious thing. They think that because they saw The Big Short that they have some deep insight into our market, which couldn't be further from the truth.
You need to explain this to me in a bath of bubbles. That's what you need to do.
Yeah, exactly. Like I lift weights, but I'm a little thick around the midsection. I don't think anyone wants to see that. But yeah, that's kind of what we're struggling against, because the assumption is that because it's not a transparent market, we're doing something, you know, nefarious. Far from it. We're trying to help people manage risk to allow development. Again, like I was mentioning earlier, we're trying to help people, you know, develop photovoltaics and wind and everything else, or carbon capture. But if they don't have an effective derivatives mean to do so, you know, that's kind of what we're up against. So yes, we wake up every day all terrified there's going to be some news article that, you know, magically this is banned. And I know people are saying that wouldn't happen, but, you know, we're not effective cheerleaders for ourselves as an industry. Again, we're very private, we're very hidden. And that's one of the hard parts where, you know, trying to communicate to I fully admit this, which makes me seem like a total moron, but when I started here, I didn't really know what an interdealer was. You know, I worked in trading, worked as a consultant, been in a bunch of places, but showed up and I'm like, what is this place? And that's kind of the disservice we do, even though as an industry, we are providing kind of that valuable risk management function.
All right. Always good to talk about self-regulating entities, isn't it? Everyone's got the old self-regulating entity somewhere.
SROs.
Yeah. Very Orwellian. Right. So to finish up, I want to know all about your this is my favorite question in the whole podcast. I want to know all about your contrarian view. I bet you've got loads, but which one do you want to share?
Probably power related, just because I like electric power. It's kind of one of my favorite things. Obviously do every you know, energy commodity, the firm brokers and model it. But, you know, particularly contrarian that I'm not convinced about net zero, particularly from a thermal standpoint, because we just, there's not enough energy there. So then the question becomes, how do you actually adjudicate that and spending around it? I also think that, you know, we're really running into some dangerous areas, particularly around like voltage ride through. These are all extremely technical, but they all matter because we look at where, you know, gross investment is. We look at order books for things, you know, like gas turbines and things like that. We're not building nukes. You know, even if we have some interest in, you know, reviving nuclear plants, NRC and stuff like that, it's not going to move fast. So I'm convinced that we're going to have, you know, thermal plants here for a long time. We're not going to replace basically the thermal fraction just largely because it is so damn energy dense. I don't believe in 100% electric EVs. Just again, it's thermal density and stuff like that. And then, you know, when you have, you know, adding 50 megawatts of, you know, charging, you know, outside of a city just to do Amazon delivery vans, that's a problem. Then you mix that with, are people going to allow transmission to be built? No, there's going to be a lot of litigation around it. I don't want that in my backyard is going to be what everyone says. So because of that, I think there's not going to be the rapid, basically move to net zero electrification. And I think it's largely because it's a political science problem, not an engineering problem. And engineering problems are relatively easy to solve. They have constrained, you know, defined areas. Political science is not. You start here with your maximal set. Anything below that's worse. So as such, I want my maximal set. So I'm only going to do politically to get my maximal set versus economics. You know, it's upper continuous. So simply because of preference functioning and stuff like that, it's going to be a bear. So I think we're going to start to see a lot of complex pushback around electrification, batteries, everything else. And I think it's largely because when you're operating a socialized machine like the power grid, you're going to deal with the implied social cost, much to the chagrin of people like the engineers at ERCOT, people working genuinely hard everywhere else, Europe. You're getting pushback because it's, again, fundamentally a political science problem that is not solved. Even when you've mapped it down, you know, relatively simplistically, these are complex and people just, again, they don't want transmission in their backyard. They probably don't want a giant, you know, battery bank next to their house. They don't want an additional, you know, coal-fired plant, natural gas plant. These are all going to be issues that are going to be hard to solve. And that's why it's difficult to move beyond kind of our current construct.
Interesting. Interesting.
I know, so it's very contrarian, especially for the industry.
Especially for our listeners. I would say, well, there is some truth in what you've said there, right? I do disagree with a lot of it, but there is certainly some truth in that we've got a big challenge in convincing people that this is the right thing to do and that getting stuff Correct. Built is more challenging than a lot of the low-hanging fruit has already been taken, right? The spaces yep. where people are happy to have transmission lines, there's already transmission lines. I think a lot of the operability issue, you talked about low voltage ride through there, I think a lot of it comes down to, I think some of it can be solved in from market design, and some of it is an interconnectivity issue. And of course, where we are at the moment, you're in Houston, I'm in Austin, Texas is not, is an island within the states. But I yep. think over large masses, particularly across, it's argued that the European power grid is the largest or most complicated or something fabulous to describe the biggest system ever or whatever. And I guess over large enough distances, renewables penetration can be managed with interconnectivity and market design. But I agree with you. We've got a big hearts and minds problem. And we've got a massive cost problem. Yeah. I'm talking about dollars, you know, euros, dollars, pounds, cost yeah. problem, which has been totally underestimated. And the people who will end up paying for it hasn't really been worked out who that's going to be yet. Correct. And so, yes, we do have a huge societal problem. But I'm hopeful. I'm extremely hopeful. And I really do hope we can get off gas as much as I love gas turbines. And I watched in awe being the geek that I am, a YouTube video about Siemens order book over Christmas and the amount of orders they are taking for turbines right now. You mean, if you want to buy a Siemens gas plant, you got to wait 3 or 4 years right now. Yep. Anyway, that was what I did on my Christmas holidays. And there's nothing wrong with that.
It's one of those where, like I said, I know I'm being contrarian. It's more, I'm pessimistic because of the political science aspect. I'm not staking out a political position or anything else. I'm just saying, you know, I've gotten phone calls from, you know, people I know who are like, how do I prevent, you know, a transmission line from being, you know, operated and, you know, raised in my backyard in the hill country? There's a sufficient number of people who are cranky about that, that adds an issue. And then as you bring up the affordability issue is, you know, nobody, at least in Houston, likes the TDU pass through, which is basically our distribution cost for how much the Powerboat costs, you know, particularly this time of year when they're like, why am I paying $150 to CenterPoint when I'm only using, you know, $50 worth of electricity? You know, trying to explain that and manage that is a difficult issue. And again, it's a political science problem. So again, I'm not pessimistic about, you know, technology or anything else. I'm pessimistic about you're trying to explain this to people, and most people just want to have the power work and come home after work and watch Netflix. And those are very difficult things when you're watching, you know, things about, you know, turbine engineering, and I'm reading, you know, release documents from the TRE and ERCOT. So this is kind of a little bit of a different audience versus your normal folks.
Yeah,
which is fine.
All right. Well, I've got to say that was an absolutely fascinating discussion. For anybody who we went really technical on a few things there, and I'm sure some of the listeners, there were some bits where people were like, can you just get on with it? But I'm really glad. Don't say sorry. I'm really glad we stuck at it. And there'll be the odd listener out there who's thinking, oh, I really enjoyed that. So if you're that listener, thank you for sticking with us. You really know your stuff. Your place in the market as an interdealer broker is fascinating, and how it links back to the old ways of trading commodities and power and all sorts of things in Chicago and elsewhere. So I want to say a massive thank you for taking the time to speak to us. I absolutely loved that conversation, and it was fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.